don't frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on December 3rd, 2017, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Rachel and Nate join me to talk about the Senate tax bill, the disastrous low-tax Kansas experiment, and the importance of tax policy for ideology. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me again in studio this week, as always, is Nate. Hey, Nate.
Great to be here, Bill.
And joining me on the line from Idaho is Rachel. Hey, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me on again.
So we're going to be talking about tax policy this week. I think that's on everyone's minds. Later in the episode, we're going to get more into detail about this tax bill that just passed the Senate, as well as what the prospects are in the House and sort of the elements that had already passed in the House version. Tax policy, I think, is something that's pretty important to talk about more abstractly, as well as in the context of what has already happened in this country at other levels of the government. So we're going to be talking contextually a lot about the Kansas experiment and some other states as well. Kansas being probably the most relevant one for this one because it's had quite a bit of years to see what the results are at this point now, and specifically Governor Brownback, former senator from Kansas, was on Capitol Hill to rally the troops as to the awesomeness of the Kansas system and to try to get them to do a similar type of quote-unquote reform for tax policy at the federal level. But again, abstractly, tax policy is pretty hugely important because, as I argued on Twitter after, you know, the vote, and there was some discussion, like you had Chuck Schumer saying stuff like, I regret what could have been. Tax reform is an issue that is ripe for bipartisan compromise. And I was pointing out that's actually completely not correct because, in fact, usually, regardless of the ideologies of political parties in any sort of a political party system, the two things that distinguish political parties from each other ideologically in terms of execution on policy is their tax policy and their budget policy, right? So basically what you decide to tax or not tax, what you decide to spend on versus not spend on, that's how you as your party implement and execute your set of priorities and represent your base constituencies. The Democrats, as our past co-host Jonathan Cohn has argued many times, are not very good at actually making that differentiation. Not only is there this tendency to push for these bipartisan compromises on this major sort of fundamental dividing line, but also the Democrats tend to not help their own constituencies and bases in these policies or actively damage them, whereas the Republicans bend over backwards to serve their donor base with these policies and, you know, serve their sort of not necessarily the mass line of their voters, because there are obviously a lot of Republican voters who don't benefit from these policies, but certainly a lot of the sort of like upper middle class and rich guy people, but especially the upper middle class from the exurbs, like a lot of those people are going to benefit from the plan or at least not be hurt particularly by it. And then the actual rich donors are going to benefit hugely. So again, it's important to think about that when we're talking about tax policy and budget policy, and keep in mind, like, the Republicans are very acutely aware of how this can be used to be the fundamental sort of dividing line between parties and ideologies. Steve Scalise, the House Majority Whip of the Republicans, as we've talked about before, he went, you know, back when he was a state legislator, he went to a international white supremacist conference to deliver a presentation that I have summarized, I think, fairly as better racism through tax policy.
Didn't he say he was David Duke without the baggage or something like that?
Right. And the idea basically being that there are a lot of Republicans who have very, very stark ideological commitments that they mask through tax policy and budget policy. And you're kind of a dupe if you thought that the Republicans actually cared about stuff like the deficit or any of that kind of thing. No, they don't care. I mean, they didn't care with the Bush tax cuts. They didn't care with any of the Bush administration policies. And then they just said under Obama that they didn't, you know, they didn't, everything had to be balanced budgets and deficit neutral and all that kind of stuff, because that was their fixation that they could use to, you know, control and curtail the Democratic spending and the Democratic tax cuts and the Democratic tax increases. So that's sort of the big picture abstract concept when we're talking about tax policy and the related, you know, coin flip side of that issue, budget policy. And the Republicans have presented a manifesto in this tax bill that passed the in the Senate this on Friday night into Saturday. They've presented like their priorities very clearly. And so, as I said, later in the episode, we're going to talk about some of the elements of that. But first, we're going to talk about some of the specifics that we've seen outside of this bill in other states where Republicans have held control. Kansas being one of the more famous examples of that. Like I said, Brownback was there in support of the federal bill. But he, you know, was reelected kind of in a surprise reelection after years of disastrous low tax policies in Kansas. So let's talk about that. Rachel, we'll start with you. Where do we begin on the topic of these state tax paradises that the Republicans create?
So in Kansas, it all started in 2012, where Brownback enacted a series of sweeping tax cuts. The biggest chunk of it was he entirely eliminated taxes on what are known as pass-through businesses. In pass-through businesses, the owners file personal returns instead of business returns. So they're often called small businesses, but the Trump Organization is made up of hundreds of pass-through businesses. So there's millions and billions of dollars at play here. So they say about 69% of income earned through pass-throughs ends up in the hands of the members of the top 1%. So this was a massive redistribution of wealth from the poor to the wealthy. They were saying, oh, there's going to be a huge business boom. It's going to pay for itself. We're going to get a shot of adrenaline into Kansas. And actually, the opposite happened. Kansas had years of unimpressive growth, and then, therefore, they had massive budget deficits. And since it's a state government, they have to balance the budget. So they did that by cutting spending on public schools, public colleges, Medicaid. Medicaid was huge. They caused nursing homes to get shut down. They really cut benefits for at-home caretakers, which left disabled people really vulnerable. So it didn't work out for Kansas the way they thought it was going to. And by 2016, some of the biggest Republican cheerleaders changed their tune completely, and they joined Democrats to override some of the worst parts of Brownback's enactments. So
I'm assuming he was like line item vetoing a lot of stuff in the budget too.
Yeah. But Republicans and Democrats worked together to override those vetoes.
And yeah, this is not the only state where this is happening, right? I mean, it's sort of the gold standard of what not to do, but
right. It sounds like Oklahoma used an oil boom as justification to cut taxes as well. They reduced the state's top income tax rate. They reduced the oil and gas production tax rate from 7% to 2%, and they gave really quote-unquote attractive tax incentives to industries. And then the oil boom ended, and the money dried up, and now they consistently fall about 20% short of what they need to fulfill their budget. It seems to be a common story, especially in the like conservative Midwest.
Yeah, I'm just looking at Oklahoma here, and it seems like, you know, these sort of like resource booms, definitely not extremely sustainable. His revenue was falling about 20% short of budgeted needs for the third year in a row. So yeah, it does seem like this is a problem. Also, going back to Kansas, I was just reading this, which we should post the article. We should post up this article, but a very long, I think like 6 month long investigation by the Kansas City Star into a lot of these issues. And one thing that really stuck out to me was a Department of Transportation spokesperson was fired for admitting that they don't have enough funding to rebuild a dangerous stretch of Interstate 70, where there's been multiple fatalities that car crashes apparently constantly. I think it's called like the suicide curve. And just for admitting to the newspaper that they didn't really have the funding for a rebuild project, they were eliminated. And it's like, yeah, that was the nail in the coffin of my time at that being the face of KDOT. And yeah, so there's a lot of sort of internal reprisal, I feel like, as well, to sort of maintain the orthodoxy here.
Yeah, it sounds like Kansas is super secretive. So they more than 90% of the laws passed by the Kansas legislature comes from anonymous authors. So we don't even know who's authoring these terrible bills that are really hurting Kansas in the name of fiscal responsibility, or really goes against our touted beliefs in open government, transparent government. So it's like, what are they really hiding? They've asked caregivers for people with disabilities to sign off on blank treatment plans. Mm. And then they later discovered that their services have been dramatically cut. So it's really, they really seem to be targeting the most vulnerable citizens in their state.
Also, to connect to what Bill was mentioning with Scalise, you know, when Kansas police shoot and kill someone, law enforcement agencies often escape scrutiny because they are allowed to provide scant details to the public. So, yeah, in Kansas, a new state law is one of the most restrictive in the nation, allowing agencies to shelve footage that could shed more light on controversial cases. So they can basically shield a lot of the videos from coming out. And we've seen that, you know, a lot of these videos have been, you know, extremely influential and important, just to be able to, especially in regards to Black Lives Matter, gaining momentum, I feel like, because people actually see these shootings occur. So, yeah, I can see why they would try to keep that under wraps there.
I think it's interesting that there's a lot of things that come up in this discussion of Kansas that sort of, and Oklahoma as well, that sort of continue to replicate around other states and also be mirrored in the discussion at the federal level. You know, I'm sure we'll talk about the issue of the handwritten edits on the bill, you know, in the Senate. Like, that is reminiscent of this lack of transparency in Kansas, you know, in terms of the transit angle and like basic things, you know, safety issues getting thrown by the wayside for budgetary reasons. There was an extensive report by one of the newspapers in Florida a few years ago that I read. It was just fascinating reporting, where they figured out that the government had changed the length of yellow lights so that people could collect more, like the local governments could collect more money from red light tickets, because they would have traffic cameras on all the lights. And so if you change the length of the yellow light, then more people would think, oh, I have time to get through the yellow light, but they'd be hit by that red light camera because it would turn red earlier than they were expecting. And the consequence of this was that just changing the length of the yellow light by a fraction, I mean, it was a very small difference in the length, was enough to generate huge new revenues for this, you know, for these local governments, but also led to a huge increase in fatalities. Because when, you know, when you change the light like that and people have an expectation of what it's going to be, it's not just, oh, I think I have time to get through this before it turns red and I won't get a ticket. It's, I think I have time to get through this before it turns red and another light turns green and I get hit.
T-boned or something like that.
Right. And, you know, also, you know, Nate was mentioning the issue of the resource booms and that Rachel brought up, you know, in Oklahoma, and the pattern is similar in Kansas. It's not necessarily based on oil, but there's obviously an agricultural dimension. What we see in the federal bill is the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge being tapped for oil drilling. Something that I, you know, wrote in a co-authored article at The Globalist in probably 2015 at this point. I'm trying to remember how far back it was. This was relatively early, I think, in Trump's sort of ascent toward the nomination, but we were, but you know, kind of trying to figure out comparisons. I know that there's been a lot of overdone comparisons between him and various sort of strongman figures around the world. But what I thought was, and the part that I contributed to the article, was the dimension that I think is more interesting, actually, is the way that certain sections of the country geographically, including places like Oklahoma and Kansas as well, are driven so heavily by resource booms and bust cycles, and how much of the policy, budgetary, tax, and general policy is driven by that. It's very similar to those countries, you know, whether it's Latin America or Africa or, you know, Eurasia, where it's the policy becomes centered around like drilling for resources or farming resources or whatever. And they, everything becomes this short-termist, like, how much money can I get out of this system as an elite person, you know, and cover the various budgetary gaps and, you know, throw money at things by slightly taxing the wealth coming from these resources that are, that is not being openly pocketed by a rich elite. And then once that money dries up, it doesn't dry up for the rich people. They've all moved it offshore or into some other investment vehicle. But the tax money that, you know, is needed to be coming in for the state operating budget is no longer coming in because that was on an annual basis. And they, you know, you spent the money already from the last year's, windfall. So, I had identified that I thought that there was a relationship between Trump's sort of ascent in the specific areas. Obviously, he was generally doing well in areas that were Republican areas to begin with. But like, there is this sort of appeal when the bust cycle happens, which had just happened. You had this huge resource boom that happened in the years running up to 2016. And then a couple years before, it kind of started going bust all around the world. And you see similar effects in places like North Dakota, which we've talked a lot about on the show, and a lot of the sort of deleterious policy effects and social transformations that happen as a result of that oil boom there. And Canada has experienced some similar things too. But like there's these areas of the United States that are like really heavily dependent on these resource cycles. And if that policy is not matched or countermatched to like mitigate for that, it becomes these really dangerous seesawing effects. And there's a lot of issues in Kansas agriculturally as well. You know, the some of the commodity prices that went down were various grains and things like that. And also there's a lot of concern about the water supply there. You know, not enough rainfall to be supporting these, and it's only going to get worse with climate change. And eventually they will have drilled all the water, you know, in the ground from the aquifers. Some of those aquifers don't recharge for 10,000 years. So not really a long-term plan once that water starts running out. And so you see certain areas of the country, especially at the state government levels, looking a lot like these sort of really resource-oriented developing nation governments that are not necessarily making the best decisions. And again, it's a lot of that has to do with rich elites making decisions about what those decisions should be. It's not like this is everyone's sitting there making stupid decisions and they, you know, it's just them doing it because they think that's the right thing to do or whatever, or they're just bad at making decisions. It's usually because somebody is trying to get rich off of it. And that's the theme that we keep seeing, whether it's Kansas, Oklahoma, or the federal level.
One more thing that's alarming to me is now that they're trying to change where the taxes are coming from. So now there's increased fuel taxes, increased cigarette taxes, increased sales taxes. And so it's really shifting that tax burden to the poor people who need to commute to their jobs, or, and disproportionately smokers are lower income, and sales tax takes a bigger percentage of poor people's money. So it's really, it's just like a double whammy of just like cutting services and then increasing taxes on the poorest people.
Yeah, and then also meanwhile, the tax breaks that are given out to companies in Kansas, they don't have to disclose you know, what those tax breaks are. So basically, yeah, you can shield a lot of these tax giveaways, and people don't know this, so they can't get mad about it, basically. So
I think at some point we'll have on a different episode. I'm still thinking about how I want to do that episode. I think we're going to probably talk about some of the Amazon stuff that's happening right now involving various tax break proposals and everything. And there's the issue with GE, which is moving to Massachusetts as well. That's something that I dealt with professionally, not those specific companies, but just the issue of the tax breaks for corporations when I was briefly working at a firm that deals with those issues. Both some of their work is for corporations, but I was working on the like municipal and state side of that. We'll talk about it more, I think, in a future episode, but sort of the short version of that is that it's very clear that the states that actually have good incentives programs, such as they are, I'm not really a fan of any of these incentives programs, but the states that benefit from the incentives programs more than they lose out on them have very high levels of transparency and very high levels of accountability built into those systems, that everything has to be carefully disclosed. There's an agreement on how many jobs are going to be created. There's sometimes even agreements about where those jobs have to be hired from so that you can't just bring in workers from other parts of the country. They have, if you don't meet those targets that were agreed to, then you have to refund the money back to the county or the state or whatever. Like, there are ways you can structure it where, you know, the corporation doesn't just make off like a bandit. Surprise, surprise, they're not really big fans of those models, though, from the corporate side of that. And that's how you get a situation like Nate was talking about in Kansas, where these companies aren't disclosing anything. And for all we know, they're saying, oh, yeah, for sure, man, I'm going to bring in 500 jobs. And then it's like 10 jobs or something, you know, or it's the similar fuzzy Republican math that we got around the Keystone XL discussions, where John Boehner would be talking about like it's going to create 2,000 pipeline jobs or whatever, and it would turn out to be like a crew of 50 moving from county to county, and it was the same 50 people being counted over and over again until it got to 2,000 or something along those lines. We keep seeing these themes. They're all really interconnected, and hopefully folks can start seeing here if they hadn't been thinking about it already, about how these things all interact with each other. And of course, it always comes back to that cuts issue at the state level. When you're talking about a state like Kansas, Rachel mentioned the balanced budget rules, where it's constitutionally required to balance a budget. Most states have a provision like that with varying levels of strictness. The federal government obviously does not. But again, like, when they have those requirements, whether it's at the state level or unofficially at the federal level, especially when the Republicans were pushing that under Obama a lot, and the Obama administration, frankly, endorsed a lot of that deficit propaganda as well. When you're talking about these balanced budget things and these deficit things, the goal is really never about the actual balancing. It's really about having a mechanism to control your priorities for taxation and spending on the budget side. As Rachel mentioned, education has been hit pretty hard in Kansas. That's one that comes up a lot because there are a lot of moderate Republicans in Kansas, you know, self-described Eisenhower Republicans, because he was from Kansas, who say, hey, education, public education is really important to us. And it always has been. And we want to make sure that our public education system is at least K-12 is being adequately funded. Obviously, a lot of the higher ed stuff has gotten really thrown out the window in many states. But, you know, they're talking K-12 and they make those budget cuts because of that balanced budget requirement. And then there's now, fortunately, some people finally starting to override those. But that's been a relatively recent development when they're really cutting a lot of these systems to the bone. And that's just sort of one example of where it becomes weaponized to advance a specific agenda. Like, obviously what happens when you start having severely under-resourced public schools is they start declining in quality and the outcomes are bad. And then all of a sudden you say, oh, we have these failing schools, but of course they're failing because they don't have enough resources. And then failing schools becomes used to like turn them all into charter schools or something like that. And then the corporations take a huge slice of the pie. Like, it's always utilized and weaponized in this way, where if you are saying that there has to be cuts to balance these other budgetary issues that you've created voluntarily because you didn't tax things properly or you didn't tax them at the right rate or whatever, or you based too much of your predictions on the level of GDP growth so the denominator would change, any of these things, the result here is that you weaponize these cuts and the logic of fixing the deficit and closing these budget gaps in order to advance certain things, which is something that has hugely emerged at the federal discussion.
Yeah, and just a couple days ago, Rubio, Little Marco, as Trump liked to call him, was doing a Politico interview discussing the whole tax bill and such. And he was asked about the federal deficit. And he replied, "We have to do two things. We have to generate economic growth, which generates revenue while reducing spending. That will mean instituting structural changes to Social Security and Medicare for the future." So basically, he's just admitting it, saying what basically all Republicans believe, that we need to massively cut Social Security and Medicare, and a lot of them want to completely eliminate them as well, I would believe. And they're using the whole discussion with deficit shortfalls and whatnot to sort of cloak their argument or just begin the process, basically.
Right. I mean, the same thing that they did with the whole Bush administration was like exploding the deficit massively. So then you have the logic of saying, well, we have to cut all these social services as soon as there's a Democratic president because we have to control the deficit. And that's completely intentional, right?
Well, and even Cheney said himself that deficits don't matter. I think he was referring to the war deficit.
Right.
But, you know, they don't actually think it matters. They just use this as part of their argument. And as we've talked about, a lot of Democrats really give them space to do this. And they also have similar, you know, questions about, we need to be pragmatic and, you know, make sure that we don't let them call us tax and spend liberals or whatever. And also one other thing I'm just remembering during the presidential campaign, there were a lot of these deficit questions at one of the debates. I think it might have been the second debate. But of course, no questions about global warming, climate change, anything like that. So obviously.
Yeah, no, hugely out of whack in terms of talking about the deficit and debt versus actual problems like climate change. But, you know, to focus again on this more narrowly, like, we should always stress, big disclaimer here, that Social Security and Medicare do not actually contribute to the deficit. So, you know, the long time thing has been create a lot of problems for the Social Security and Medicare system and raid the trust funds for those and then rack up a huge deficit so that you can combine all these factors to say, oh, well, now we have to bail out Medicare and Social Security, but we're not actually going to do that because of deficit reasons. So now it's finally time to privatize it or cut the benefits dramatically or severely raise the retirement age, even though a lot of the people who work, you know, backbreaking menial labor jobs would really be hit hard by that. Any number of these things that, you know, the big structural reforms. And Bernie Sanders, back before he was, you know, famous for his presidential campaign, had always been pushing this bill of saying, look, we can fix a lot of the budgetary issues internal to Social Security and Medicare by slightly changing how we do the payroll tax system. Right now, there's a cap and, like, you know, they figure a bunch of people making a certain amount of money aren't going to need Social Security and they're, you know, so they just don't need to pay into it either. But he was saying, no, like, everyone should have to pay the full amount on all their income and that would generate enough revenue to get us through, you know, 2068 or whatever. I think I remember the number being, you know, 7 or so years ago when he was pushing this. And then he brought up a bill during this recent Senate debate or an amendment saying that, you know, explicitly protecting Social Security and Medicare from these cuts. And three of the Democrats voted with the Republicans to block that amendment. I don't know if it would have passed anyway, but, you know, there was maybe one Republican who crossed over to vote for it. But, you know, even three of the Democrats are so hyped up on this propaganda about the deficit and the need for structural reform in Social Security and Medicare, which are systems that are doing fine and can be expanded to make them stronger, that they went and voted for this. And, you know, obviously Mark Warner kind of leading the charge on that, but as well, Dick Durbin, who's the number two in the Senate Democrats. So it's just like, come on, man. Like, you know, I don't know. Unless Durbin was somehow voting against it, doing the procedural thing to be able to bring it back up later, because you, in order to bring something back up, you have to vote against and then flip later. But I don't know that he's doing that. I'm just throwing out wild speculation here, but it didn't look good to me anyway. We're going to go to a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to get into the details of this recent tax bill now that we've kind of laid the groundwork for this. So Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. Please stick around. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate, and on the line from Idaho is Rachel. We've been talking so far this hour about tax policy, the broader ideological implications of that, the Kansas experiment, and now we're going to talk in more depth about the details of the federal bill that just passed through the Senate, as well as sort of the bigger picture on that, which I think is probably going to actually pass into law, but remains to be seen. Nate, I guess, why don't you walk us through what are some of the details in this monstrosity? I mean, they really seem to throw in everything they could think of, including stuff that wasn't really tax related at all. I saw there was something about they tried to say that, like, redefine, like, fetal life or something like that. And then the parliamentarian was like, hey, guys, that's not actually tax policy. You can't just change some tax coding around personhood to get do an end run around that and still vote it through with only 51 votes. But that goes to show that there was a lot in this that was not tax related or was a little bit off the beaten path. So let's talk about some of these details, tax or otherwise. What is in this bill that passed through the Senate before this weekend?
Well, as you mentioned, there's a whole ton of different things. I think corporate tax rate is getting cut from 35 to 20%. That's in both the House and Senate versions, because there are some differences between them, obviously, that have to be reconciled. I'm just scrolling down here through the winners and losers type of thing. People who care about the debt are the losers. Okay, that's not really relevant.
Not a real thing, Washington Post.
As we talked about that, but okay. The poor, losers. Definitely, they are seeing...
Yeah, some really colorful quotes this weekend on the Sunday shows and to the local newspapers from Orrin Hatch and Chuck Grassley about all the moochers that are not using their money
responsibly to pay
for health insurance.
They're having too
or
much avocado toast.
Why the estate tax needs to be cut. Yeah.
This also will affect, I guess, the health insurance markets. It's expected to cause a spike in premiums and 13 million Americans to drop insurance coverage in the next decade. So, it's sort of like it includes the repeal of the individual mandate. Is that exactly?
Yeah, so the individual mandate for health insurance is a tax. That was how they implemented the mandate element of it. And so they had originally been trying to remove that in the last bill. And of course, you know, people like Murkowski pretending to be something that they're not, which is not conservative, and pretending to be upstanding people, were like, oh, we can't possibly remove the individual mandate because it will cause all kinds of chaos in the health insurance systems and marketplaces and everything. And now, you know, she voted for it this time when it wasn't a healthcare bill and people weren't paying as much attention.
I think I saw something online about how what they promised to, like, buy off Susan Collins with, they just admitted that they're not actually going to do that. So,
well, yeah, so there were two things. She got some sort of property tax exemption that benefits a lot of people in Maine. But she also, like, got, you know, a signed letter from Mitch McConnell saying that they wouldn't target Social Security and Medicare when it's time to go control the deficit. Because I think there's some sort of automatic deficit reduction trigger type mechanism in this. And I mean, we know Susan Collins loves her trigger mechanisms and everything, because there was some sort of a discussion about whether or not there should be a public option trigger in the Affordable Care Act. And then we didn't end up getting a public option at all. So in retrospect, I don't know, maybe we should have gone with that trigger thing. But I guess the argument was that it would be repealed later. The trigger can be repealed. But in this case, they're not going to repeal the trigger because they want to do these deficit cuts like we talked about in the last segment. So what else we got in this bill?
Yeah, so in the House bill, I believe a lot of this will affect college and grad students. The House bill eliminates the popular student loan write-off and forces graduate students who receive tuition waivers to count that money as income for tax purposes. So they have to, even though they don't actually receive the money in their pockets. And basically, this could be pretty disincentivizing to people going to graduate school and massively affect the people that do a lot of graduate students are workers and they do a lot of the scientific research in STEM fields and things like that. So this could have a pretty serious impact on them. So that's one thing. And then there was also, we were discussing this before the show about the teachers and whether, you know, there would be a deduction for buying classroom supplies and things like that. And I think the Senate bill doubles the current deduction, but the House bill eliminates it. So we're not exactly sure how that's going to shake out, but I guess we'll see.
That reminds me as well I guess they're going to have to reconcile these two bills unless the House just goes and passes the Senate version. Do we know, is there any indication at this point of what the sort of final bill might look like, or if they're just going to pass the Senate version? I was thinking specifically about the handwriting issue, which I don't know if you want to talk about that, but...
Yeah, well, there was all the sort of scribbled margins, handwriting there. And I did see someone, some like conservative wonk or whatever, Avik Roy, I think, and he was to like, oh, well, the Declaration of Independence was handwritten, so there you go. Another thing in the bill that Democrats, I believe, got rid of, but it was a provision that would have shielded Hillsdale College, a conservative school in Michigan, from a new tax on university endowments. And I believe the people there, the presidents there, are buddies with like the DeVoses.
Yeah, it's a very conservative institution. I think, is this the one that, like, I could be wrong. I think this is the one that brags that they don't accept federal student loans.
Right, right.
Because they're so ideologically opposed to it. Oh. But apparently would be fine taking a tax break.
Here we go. Eric Prince, Betsy DeVos's brother, and Blackwater guy, is a Hillsdale graduate. So there you go. That's it's pretty clear. But I guess, yeah, so Democrats blocked it.
Yeah, although Democrats were blocking it for kind of the wrong reason, which is that they love the liberal universities that have the big endowments. Because in general, abstractly speaking, it would probably be a good idea to be taxing some of these endowments, at least on very rich institutions.
Well, the bill does do that, I believe. And yeah, Harvard is listed as one of the losers because it's a House and Senate bills create a new 1.4% tax on private college endowments worth over $500,000 per student. And only a handful of universities have such large endowments. Most are Ivy League schools like Harvard. So,
right. That was what I heard on Friday from, I was talking to some union organizers in Massachusetts, and they were saying that the Republican version of taxing endowments would be to just tax the really, really, really top tier ones that could really only pretty much apply to Harvard and maybe a couple others. But there is actually a proposal by some of the unions in Massachusetts to tax endowments because there's a lot of schools in Massachusetts with endowments. They were going to tax it specifically to create a universal pre-K system, which is an interesting proposal that I think we should look more into and talk about some of the, I mean, we've talked about pre-K in general, but that's an interesting concept for funding it. Yeah, this is the Republican version of that, which is that they really, really hate Harvard. I mean, a lot of them went to Harvard or Harvard Law, But abstractly, they sure do like yelling about Harvard. Now, this is one of their main points of contention with Elizabeth Warren is that she was a Harvard professor. So as Jonathan Cohen always says, the Republicans really go all out to take down their ideological enemies and the people that the institutions they perceive as supporting the Democrats, whereas the Democrats do not seem to do that much to protect it. Although in this case, they did, I guess, mitigate some of the policy there.
Yeah, there's also, I'm reading in the Washington Post, they went out somewhere in Michigan, went to a bowling alley and started trying to talk to Trump supporters. And they did not actually seem like they were totally on board with this situation. A lot of them were pretty skeptical that they would benefit under it. So they don't expect to benefit under the proposal. You know, he's saying, why are you trying to lower their taxes? Naming some like wealthy families in the local area. So the level of lifestyle they have versus everyone else, why do they need that? So it's kind of weird that sometimes some of these Trump voters, like in a way they sort of like intuitively get it in like a version of it, but they sort of, because of their position or whatever, they basically have to just suck it up when the Republican Congress just decides
the
whole Laffer curve thing.
A lot of them thought that they were elect. I mean, a lot of the people knew what they were voting for with Trump. But I think there were definitely some voters who thought that they were electing Trump as a wealthy tribune who knows how to operate among these rich people and fight for the common man against these fellow rich people. President deals. He's going to get all these deals done and the jobs are going to come back and we're going to make America great again. I guess that was what some of them thought, but I don't know that there's that much value in spending all the time talking to these people after every single legislative blow to see,
in on them. There's been millions of these like journeys in Trump land, and some of them have been actually quite hilarious, but yeah.
All right, Rachel, I want to get your thoughts on which of any of these elements in this tax bill have jumped out at you the most. What what is getting your goat this week?
Well, the Hillsdale provision. I think it's kind of rich that they're framing they're not taking federal money as like an independent stand when really it's because they won't abide by federal non-discrimination standards. So I think it's
potato.
Yeah, exactly. That must not bother the Republicans too much. Segregation in higher education. But also, yeah, I know the teacher thing has made a lot of people angry, which is probably why the Senate actually increased the amount of money teachers can write off. We already disrespect our teachers so much. It's really infuriating to see the denigration of education, both primary, secondary, and higher education as well, just being really on so much.
I guess the left perspective was the teacher shouldn't have to be buying their own supplies anyway, because it should be fully covered by resources allocated to this. The liberal perspective was, can you believe that they're cutting the deduction that allows our hardworking teachers to buy their own markers?
Right,
and then I guess there were some conservatives who must have thought, well, no, actually, we should give them a tax deduction on this because we want teachers to be buying their own supplies so we don't have to buy them supplies.
Right.
You know, I guess there's something for everyone in this issue.
Right. So maybe that's why they increased it there.
Right. That's my guess of why they would have done that.
I was puzzled when I saw that. I was like,
right. I mean, because they don't like teachers very much. But, you know, again, the teachers unions tend to back the Democrats and they hate the teachers unions and they hate unions. So I can see why they abstractly might have thought about taking away that tax deduction. But if it does indeed survive that this higher deduction in the final version, the only guess that I can come up with is that they figured, well, if we increase the deduction on how much teachers can write off for school supplies, then we can also all over the country in conservative areas cut the budget for teacher supplies. Mm-hmm. That, I mean, and they'll cut it by more than they're offsetting it with this deduction increase for sure. Anything else that you particularly were thinking about?
Just that the Democratic response has been so lackluster. The Senate Democrat Twitter posted a Ronald Reagan quote about bipartisanship. And in these times, people are angry. People are scared for their future. And so tweeting platitudes from Ronald Reagan is just, it's the completely wrong message to send. And I think this is definitely going to hurt the Democrats in 2018. If we just see them as kind of falling down and talking about respectability, like that's what I believe Claire McCaskill was complaining about. Not the fact that they're trying to vote on this bill. It's the fact that they were trying to vote on this bill Friday night instead of Monday. So it's just a really sad response from the Democrats. And I know a lot of people have a lot of fire in their bellies right now, and the wet blankets of the Democrats are not helping at this time.
Yeah, then people have been like arguing about whether it's okay to criticize the Democrats and then like, oh, what more could they have done or whatever. But
right, because it did come down. I mean, like at the end of the day, yeah, it came down to a vote issue and that they did not have the votes. And we're lucky, honestly, that we didn't have more Democrats defecting to vote in favor of this. But and I'm being flippant about that. But yeah, I mean, to some extent, this was like they were going to get it done as long as the Republicans were not defecting, right? Because the Republicans have more votes. That's the way it goes. But I think a lot of people quite rightly were like, they were looking for a fight, and they feel like the Democrats not only didn't go down fighting, like it's like, yeah, we know you were going to lose, but you got to fight all. And we want you to fight. We want you to draw these lines in the sand so we can feel good about going out to support you and putting in our time and everything. But more than that is just that, like, also you didn't really draw attention to this. Like, there was a lot more attention on the healthcare bill stuff than there was on this. And there were a number of factors for that. And you can, you know, I mean, this is a more complicated thing to talk about. It's more multidimensional than the healthcare one. Like, I can kind of see maybe how some of that happened. I think also some of the Democrats got lured into a false sense of security after a couple close shaves didn't, you know, come pan out on the healthcare thing. They maybe thought that was going to keep happening. I don't think that was a good assumption. Also, to be brutally honest, a lot of folks talking about that Flynn stuff and that Russia stuff literally all morning and all afternoon in the run up to this vote. Why were you talking about that? Like, I personally don't know how significant that's actually going to proved to be. I'm kind of skeptical on that. But like, even if it was super significant, unless it was going to cause Trump to literally resign that day and like force a constitutional crisis, it did not matter that day. You know,
that's what these people think, basically, that he's only like one Mueller time. Yeah. indictment away from being, you know, frog marched out of the White House. Right. But
and it's like I mean it's hard enough to talk news on a Friday, but you lost the entire cycle by talking about the Russia stuff again, which most people are not that political and are going to start zoning out when you're talking about it constantly, even if it's as bad as these people are saying it is. And you could have been talking about this tax bill and the implications of that. I don't know. I found that to be really grating and puzzling that people were talking about that. I didn't talk about it at all on Friday. I didn't feel any need to. The tax bill seemed like it kind of mattered more. I don't know.
Yeah, and then people argue about McCain again. And
Let's talk about that. Rachel, any impressions on the McCain stuff?
So I think a lot of liberals are attacking the leftist for making some unsavory jokes about McCain and his battle with brain cancer. And yeah, the liberals are just like, why aren't you being decent instead of rightly attacking McCain for dooming so many people to a horrible death?
Yeah.
It goes to that kind of respectability over messaging.
I guess, yeah, one of the big things, I don't know if we emphasized it enough in this, like we were talking about, you know, corporate tax cuts and things like that, which obviously, like, I don't think that ExxonMobil, which it paid in 2016 a negative 5% income tax on its its revenue or its profits between various deductions and subsidies and everything and various state and, you know, all kinds of different things, they weren't paying 35%. They don't need the tax rate to be cut that much or at all. But the other thing that really, you know, kind of shone through in this was the estate tax, which I thought it was sort of a clever play by the Republicans. Rather than straight up repealing the estate tax, they just raised the exemption threshold so high that almost no one is affected by it. Like very, very, very few people are affected by it, which I'm sure those few people are all Republicans who are furious with them, you know, with the exception of a couple liberal billionaires here and there. But
Soros.
But aside from that, like the exemption on like the normal level rich people, which includes people like John McCain, you know, that estate tax exemption going way up so that their kids are going to make a ton of money. And then, you know, people made remarks about that and the fact that Meghan McCain and people like that are going to make a big amount of money off this, which the meaning of that was at some point John McCain will die. Not John McCain is imminently on death's doorstep.
Right.
But you know, for some reason, whether they were conservative whiners or these liberal respectability people, they were going on and on about this, like, you know, implying that McCain was, you know, that this was an attack on McCain's cancer or something like that, as opposed to the fact that just McCain is a mortal human who will at some point pass away and his kids are materially going to benefit from that, which is worth discussing.
Right. Well, these types have always beloved McCain ever since the Straight Talk Express days of the 2000 campaign. So that's sort of to be expected, I guess, at this point. But yeah, it is interesting.
You can't talk smack about John Keating 5 McCain, a national hero.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, his name doesn't really get brought up in reference to that, but I remember like learning about the Keating 5 scandal at one point and then afterwards realizing that McCain was part of it.
Like, he's one of the five.
Yeah, they've divorced him very much, but he is one of the five. So,
because he was cleared or whatever, you know, along with some of the others. But yeah, no, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to spend too much time on it, I guess. That sort of ongoing reaction, it was annoying enough when it was the healthcare vote and he did actually, I don't know, he made a thing about how he wasn't going to vote for it. And then he did go and vote for something procedurally, but then he voted against it with a big old thumbs down. And they all got really excited about this and were West Wing music swoops under their tweets and whatever. Anyway, but then now he did vote for this and still the reaction was, I can't believe he voted for this. What a surprise. And oh, this is just so out of character. And it's like, what are you talking about? His whole career has been building up to this, ultimately. I mean, in his head, his whole career was building up to a dramatic thumbs down on something where he was going to save the Republic. But in actuality, his career was building toward a run-of-the-mill, standard, conservative, budgetarian tax vote. Which I guess that's sort of the thing we should close out on here is, do we think that this would be different under any president other than Trump? I mean, he didn't really have that much to do with this other than continually being quote unquote on message, as Reuters put it, which they clarified meant lying about saying over and over again that it was the biggest tax cut ever, which isn't true. But I mean, is this, I didn't see this as being connected to Trump. To me, this just seemed like what would have happened under any Republican Congress or the Republican president. I mean, do we see any distinction here, really?
I mean, I think this is more or less what all Republicans believe, going back, as I mentioned a little earlier, to the Laffer curve drawn on Dick Cheney's napkin. Basically, this is just part of the orthodoxy. They're indoctrinated into this belief system. And then, of course, people will argue, oh, but it benefits me. I'm getting a tax cut and things like that. So that's sort of how they bring it to the ordinary people. But as we saw with the Trump voters in the Washington Post article, a lot of them are actually pretty skeptical. But that doesn't really seem to matter to the people that write the bills, the Republicans in Congress, because why would it?
I know my taxes are going to go up in a few years by a few hundred dollars, and then in 10 years it's going to be, you know, like $700 or $800, I saw in one chart that somebody posted. But yeah, I mean, half these guys in the Senate and House were raised on Ronald Reagan. They were 17, you know, or in college or whatever, and they worshiping Reagan. I mean, that's the irony of posting that Reagan quote, of course, is that this Reagan tax stuff, this is them trying to enact and reenact Reagan. They're cosplaying.
Paul Ryan was at the kegger talking about cutting Medicare and Social Security. And now it comes back to that. So this is
a dork.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who talks about that at cake parties?
Rachel, you want to close us out here? Any final thoughts on this?
I think in 2018, Democrats have to tie this not to Trump, but to the Republicans, because like we've just said, it's something they've been dreaming about for 8 years under Obama. So it's really we need to tie it to them. And I know that not very many senators are up in 2018, but the entire House is. So I think if Democrats have a strong message of tying this tax bill to the Republicans, maybe we can win a few more seats and kind of change the tide.
All right. And Trump, by definition, isn't on the ballot in 2018. So if you're going to win Republican seats, and you have to win Republican seats in order to, you know, try to win back control of Congress, you're going to have to somehow make the case that these people are bad because they're Republicans, not just bad because they like Trump or whatever. I mean, he's more popular than most of them are. So that, you know, you're going to have to make a case that the Republican agenda broadly is a problem, and that's why you should elect Democrats.
Mm-hmm. And by the same token, Democrats need to be primaried by really strong leftist activists and candidates, because we've seen the recent wins in Virginia and other states. And I think that message is really attractive to voters, and whereas the Democratic message is just not as inspiring to get out the vote.
And I would say broadly, in the sense of primaries, that some of them are going to be primaries for Republican-held seats or open seats, and they need to be contested primaries as opposed to being coronations for somebody from the establishment. It doesn't necessarily have to be primarying an incumbent. Sometimes it's just about winning the primary for a seat that a Republican holds or is an open seat. All right, Nate, thank you so much for being in studio this week.
Thanks, Bill.
And Rachel, thank you for joining me again.
Thanks. It's always a pleasure.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFD Radio or email AFDradio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from arsenalfordemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntberg. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on arsenalfordemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.